Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, we'll speak with the Silicon Valley venture capitalist who wants to split California into six states and says he has the signatures to put the issue to voters in 2016.
But first, where are we in the crisis in the Middle East? There was a short respite over the weekend, but fighting resumed. And today, Gaza police say Israeli airstrikes hit Shifa Hospital, the main hospital in Gaza, as well as a nearby park where they say at least 10 Palestinians were killed. The Israeli military denies the claim, saying rockets misfired by Hamas militants are to blame. Daniel Estrin is reporting for NPR from Jerusalem. And Daniel, we're seeing pictures reportedly from the hospital. A terrible scene there. What is the importance of Shifa Hospital?
Well, Shifa Hospital is the main hospital in Gaza, and it's the number one place in Gaza that's always been considered off limits. The wounded are brought there from strikes. So this is a very serious incident.
Well, Daniel, people can be forgiven for losing track here. We heard both sides announcing their own temporary ceasefires and then accusing the other of breaking that. Where are we now?
Hamas announced a 24-hour ceasefire because of the tough situation that the Palestinians are in Gaza, and also because of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, which is a three-day holiday that began today. But still, Israel said that at least a dozen rockets were launched at Israel during that time that Hamas had announced its 24-hour ceasefire. Meanwhile, Israel says it's adhering to its own ceasefire. It calls it a limitless pause in fighting. And still, despite that limitless pause in fighting, it says it's attacked rocket launchers in Gaza and has responded to militant fire and is also continuing to destroy militant tunnels on the border. And so, the UN says that both Israel and Hamas have expressed serious interest in an additional 24-hour ceasefire, but there is no consensus on if the two parties are going to agree on that together. And it's quite a confusing situation.
Well, what's the mood where you are? People are making a lot of the fact that Israelis seem to be unified over how to go forward here.
Yeah, I mean, an opinion poll that was released in Israeli media shows that nearly 90% of Israelis, or it suggests that nearly 90% of Israelis support the continuation of the ground invasion. And that public support is really apparent here. And I'm just driving along the highways as I'm driving around reporting, I see Israeli army flags that have been put up on along the highways here and inside Jerusalem. Other different posters, things that say like army, we're with you, and different slogans like, let the army win.
Well, but are they aware of international opinion? I mean, around the world, people are seeing pictures of Palestinian children being pulled from rubble. And the UN chief, who's calling for an unconditional, immediate end to fighting, had some harsh things to say about Israel.
Yes. Today, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said some very serious things. It seems as if every time he speaks, he's even more furious and singling out Israel. In today's comments, he said Gaza is in critical condition because of Israel's bombardment of Gaza and that civilians have been killed. And he said it raised, quote, serious questions about proportionality. So I called up the Israeli spokesman for the foreign ministry and asked him about those serious questions about proportionality. And he says Israel has perfect legal answers to that question of proportionality. And he says, according to international law, the Israeli military is allowed to respond according to the nature of the threat. And he said the current threat is thousands of missiles fired indiscriminately at Israeli cities, risking the lives of millions. And the proportional thing to do, he said, according to Israel, is to do what is necessary to remove that particular threat. So we do see harsher and harsher words from the international community and more defiance on Israel's side.
And Daniel, before we let you go, where are we on that terrible incident that took place last Thursday? At least 15 Palestinians reported killed at a UN school they'd taken refuge in. Israel did its own investigation. What is it now saying?
Well, Israel says it has completed its investigation into that incident, and it says that it's rejecting claims that its fire killed those Palestinians at that school. Israel released a video, and it's saying that video shows that only one errant mortar hit the courtyard of the school, and that no one was in the courtyard when that happened. So then the question is, well, how did all those people die at the school? And Israel is saying that perhaps those people were killed by Israeli fire or by errant Hamas fire in a different place and then brought into the courtyard afterwards. And that's a claim that Israel hasn't provided any video footage or any evidence to back up.
Reporter Daniel Estrin, he is reporting for NPR in Jerusalem. Daniel, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And Robin, we've heard people talk about a two-state solution as one possible way out of the problems in the Middle East. Here in this country, there are some people talking about a six-state solution in California. There's a proposal that could be on the ballot in the state in 2016 to divide the Golden State into six new states if officials approve the more than 1 million signatures submitted. Six Californias is the brainchild of Silicon Valley entrepreneur Tim Draper, a billionaire who's invested in companies like Skype, Hotmail, and Baidu. He's with us now from Stanford University. Tim Draper, welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me on the show, Jeremy.
Well, make your case for us. Why do you think California should be split into six different states?
Well, I grew up in California, and I grew up in the state that was number one in education, best place to do business, best infrastructure, and best weather. And that was 40 years ago. And all we've got now is the best weather. Schools have gone, K-12 schools have gone from first in the nation to 47th in the nation. As a place to do business, we've gone from the best place to do business to literally the worst, 50th out of 50. Prisons have quadrupled in size. We have four times as many prisoners as we did 40 years ago. And we have the most people below the poverty line. We have 20%, almost 20% of the people in California live below the poverty line. So the government has gone very much downhill. We're not getting the best service for our money.
So why would breaking the state up into six states help those problems?
Right. Our government has gotten very isolated. It's a large group in Sacramento, very isolated, and they're doing their best. And we've had governments from all sides of the aisle, and the people have gotten further distant from their government. And I think we need an opportunity for the people to be closer to their government, to make it local, and also to create a little bit of a choice so that people can easily move from maybe one state to another. It forces those governments to really perform, and we potentially end up with a much better platform from which all of these states can grow.
Well, and let's talk about those six states. We would have Silicon Valley would be one of them. Jefferson would be another. That would be the far northern part of California. North California would include Sacramento. Central California would include the agricultural Central Valley of the state. West California would include Los Angeles, but some of the suburban areas in Los Angeles would be in South California, which would also include San Diego. How did you decide on those states?
They were drawn according to various items, economics, political, made sure each one of them was a good melting pot. It turns out also they seem to have very different interests and very different personalities. There are two regions that are currently, with the current regime, very poor regions. And those poor regions, with a new platform for growth, could become very very successful states. So new governments can really make a big impact on the people.
But you do have a lot of critics of this idea, and I want to get through a few of them. And one of them, it's not even a critic, it's just a clause in the U.S. Constitution, Article 4, Section 3, says new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new states shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state. So how do you get past that hurdle?
I actually think this movement will not just bring us six states in California, but I think it will open up other states to potentially get closer to their constituents.
But how would you do that within the bounds of the U.S. Constitution?
Oh, I've run this through many great constitutional lawyers, and they have all said that this is perfectly fine.
But Congress would have to say yes to it.
Yes, that's true. It acts pretty much like a law after California says, yes, we want this to be six states. Then the rest of the country needs to figure out whether they want six new states. It turns out that when the United States wanted to bring Alaska in, they brought in Hawaii at the same time because it was a compromise, a political compromise. I guess one was Democrat and one was Republican at that time.
But I do think of the people
in... same kind of thing would probably happen here. Maybe you'd end up with six Californias and two Illinois and three... You might end up with 60 states when all is said and
Well, and I think of the people in Washington, D.C. who are listening to this and saying, wait a minute, we don't even have a state and we've got hundreds of thousands of people here who have no representation in Congress. You're asking for six times the number of senators that you have now.
Well, it turns out that California has 38 million people and they've always had two senators. And it's not just because of the number of people. It's also because different issues are important to different people within California. I mean, in immigration law, which is the hot topic now, the people in San Diego are very concerned with the border, and people in Silicon Valley are very concerned with H-1B visas. So I would think being a representative of California, being one of our two senators, would be a very difficult job because they're trying to balance the interests of all the people, all 38 million of us up and down this coast, and it's a very difficult job.
We're speaking with Silicon Valley venture capitalist Tim Draper, who is behind the plan to split California into six states. He says he's got the signatures to put the issue on the ballot in 2016. You can weigh in at hereandnow.org or at our Facebook page, facebook.com/hereandnowradio.
And Jeremy, people already are. Mary Wellmeyer is for the plan, but she says, I think three states would do the trick. Kevin Campbell is against it. He said this is a plan by wealthy people who don't seem to want to pay taxes and who don't want the taxes they do pay to go to the poor. I guess gated communities aren't good enough for them. In other words, he thinks it's about separating out the poor from the rich.
And one of the criticisms that has been brought up, you can weigh in right now at facebook.com/hereandnowradio. And let's get back to our conversation with Silicon Valley venture capitalist Tim Draper, who wants to split California into six states. And Tim Draper, the group One California opposes your move. Here is Stephen Mavilio, who represents that group.
You have to think about this as how unworkable and ridiculous it is. The cost of splitting up the pension system, the cost of trying to take apart the water system in our state, the cost of creating six more legislatures with 600 more politicians and six lieutenant governors, and all those systematic things cost billions and billions and billions of dollars.
You have to admit there would have to be a lot of bureaucracy to get people. For instance, your car would have to be registered in a different state, and there would have to be six governors and six different legislatures and all that.
There would be some short-term costs, but there'd be some great long-term benefits. And I disagree, actually. I actually think there would be less bureaucracy with six states. In fact, if you put any other six states together in the United States, they would have less bureaucracy per capita than we do. It is interesting that the opposition is coming from Sacramento and from people who are lobbyists. I mean, I think they don't want their boat rocked. They kind of have had control over the state the way they want the control over the state. And I think by creating six new Californias, it ends up being much more of a democracy where we're all in it together and we're all trying to make it work.
What about the fact that this has been tried 200 times before to split California and it's never worked?
Well, there's always a first time. Right now, California operates pretty much as a monopoly. They'll give whatever service they want for whatever cost they charge. If you had two states, you'd probably just have two monopolies. And this is the first time that anyone has come to the idea of creating six new states in the land mass that is California.
I assume you would live in Silicon Valley, that state.
I do now, yeah.
But would you stay in that one if you got your six states?
Well, what's great is that with six states, people would be able to stay in this beautiful place and be able to move if they felt that their government was not representative and not supportive. And I think I'm kind of weird this way. I like paying tax dollars. I like where it goes. I want it to go to the best, the state that does the best job with it.
But there are
the Silicon Valley, and that would be terrific.
But there are some who might think that this whole attempt is, people in Silicon Valley, rich people in Silicon Valley who want their own state and let some of the other problems of the state of California be in these other states.
Well, it actually does more for the other parts of California than it does for the Silicon Valley, but it does a lot for the Silicon Valley. There can be a concentrated effort to encourage entrepreneurship, H-1B visas, but the other states all benefit in big ways because with the current regime, Silicon Valley is doing great. Everything's fine. In the other states, in the other proposed states, they're not necessarily doing so well.
There has been criticism, Tim Draper, of how the signatures have been gathered for this effort. I want you to just respond to that. The idea that some things have been said to get people to sign on to this that are not true, such as the California Attorney General Kamala Harris supports this plan, which in fact she does not.
There were 1,000,003 signatures gathered for this initiative. We needed 808,000. When people gather signatures, the person who signs has the ability to read the entire initiative. And if they are not happy, if they sign something that they're not happy with, there is a process for going back and changing that. But that said, I think this is just politics. The powers that be, the current regime is seeing – going to throw up a lot of speed bumps along the way. We think we have plenty of signatures, and I think we're going to be on the ballot for November of 2016. And what's great about that is we have 2 years and 4 months to all discuss it and figure out how our states would be run and think about what those states could be like and how great they could be. And I think that could be a great process. So that 2 years and 4 months is going to be a great process coming to where all the counties can self-organize into new states.
So you've made a lot of very good bets in your career on different companies that you've invested in. What would your bet be about when this would happen? In your dream scenario, when California splits into six states, when does that happen?
So it's true. I've spent most of my life focusing on the future and trying to make sure the future is something of great value and trying to look to see what changes could happen to improve the way we all live. And I've been very fortunate in that I made some good investments in some companies where those entrepreneurs were really, really made a big impact on us, Tesla and Hotmail and Skype. They've really made big impacts on our society. And so I'm always looking to the future. And in looking to the future with respect to California, I didn't like what I saw. I mean, a lot of the times you look to the future by looking into the past and trying to project out. And if you look into the past, over the past 40 years, California has really gone from the best to the worst governed state in the country. And that's been a slide that will continue down if something isn't done. So I really felt that we needed something here to make a big impact on California and to give us a fresh start. And so I think that's what this is all about. I suspect the vote will take place in November of 2016. And then there will be time then for the states to self-organize and there will be 24 people, one senator, one assembly person, and two county supervisors from each of these states to negotiate state compacts. And then once that is done, then it's open for the federal government to decide when they deem it the right time to bring six Californias into the fold. So I think that could be anywhere from 2018 to 2028. That's probably the time frame. But boy, will we all be better off when that starts to happen.
Silicon Valley entrepreneur Tim Draper talking about his plan to split California into six states. Tim Draper, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
And we're also going to hear this week from the other side, the side that wants to keep California as one state. And you can weigh in at our website, hereandnow.org. I will say, Robin, one thing that's a little disappointing about this plan is I think the names they came up with for the different states.
North, South.
North California, South California. They're a little bit boring. They could have done better.
We'd love to hear your ideas. It's a serious subject, but we could have
but this
some fun
part's
with the
not
names.
That
I mean, you know, it could be Big Tree Land
Big Tree.
Or Beach Boy Country.
Hillville.
Let us
I don't know.
Hereandnow.org. July is the most dangerous month for lightning. Two visitors on separate trips to Colorado were struck and killed earlier in the month. But lightning in California, that's rare. And yesterday, a bolt hit Venice Beach, killing one swimmer, injuring several others. According to witnesses, it was the proverbial bolt from the blue.
Freakiest part about it is there was clear blue sky overhead. The storm clouds were kind of down further south. So it was like at the tip of the storm. That's why all, you know, none of the lifeguards had pulled anybody from the water.
That sound from CBS TV in Los Angeles. John Jensensius is a lightning safety specialist with the National Weather Service in Maine. And John, is that a real scientific phrase, bolt from the blue?
Yeah, it is what we call a bolt from the blue, which actually means there is blue sky in the area. However, it's actually from a thunderstorm cloud. Lightning can strike outward from a thunderstorm about 10 miles, and that's about the distance that you can hear thunder. So if you can hear thunder, you're within striking distance of the storm. But in their particular case, it's not that unusual that somebody that struck has some blue sky overhead or nearby.
Well, quite something. And as he said, normally when lifeguards see weather approaching, they call everybody out of the water. In this case, they didn't even have time. And a terrible tragedy there. But, you know, am I right that I lived in California? I don't remember seeing any lightning there.
Well, lightning is fairly rare, particularly along the water's edge there. Typically, though, we only see about 85,000 lightning strikes in a typical year. You compare that to a state like Florida, where Florida, a little smaller state, but has 1.2 million lightning strikes in a typical year.
Yeah, we're reading Florida had 46 deaths between 2004 and 13. So Florida obviously has the most humidity and the most lightning. We seem to think that they go together, but we have a favorite story. We spoke with John Friedman, the author who wrote a book about lightning, and we'll link you to that conversation at hereandnow.org. He spoke about something called the 30-30 theory, that you count to 30 or something. And some of our listeners said, well, that doesn't apply anymore. So set the record for us. What should people do if they feel that they're about to be in a lightning field? How can you protect yourself?
The most important thing is just simply remember if you hear thunder, you're within striking distance of the storm and need to get to a safe place immediately. We don't recommend standing outside and counting anymore. It's best just to get inside where you're going to be safe.
When you say safety, what is safe?
When we talk about safety, we're talking about inside a substantial building, one that has wiring or plumbing, or in a hard-topped metal vehicle. The reason for the hard-topped metal vehicle is if it's struck, the lightning will follow the metal shell around the vehicle, and you'll be safe inside. In terms of a building, the reason we say wiring and plumbing is because if lightning strikes the building, it'll probably go through either the wiring or the plumbing to ground.
If you can't get into a perfectly safe place like that, we know don't stand next to a tree, don't stand right out in the open. But what about if you have technology in your hand? Should you get rid of your cell phone? Is that going to attract lightning?
Metal doesn't really attract lightning, so it's not nothing is going to attract lightning. The thing you really want to do is there's some things you want to avoid. You want to avoid, as you said, tall trees. You don't want to be in the open, but you also don't want to lie on the ground because most people that are struck by lightning are struck by what's called the ground current. Lightning strikes either a tree, an object, and then it spreads out along the ground, and that's what hits most people. So you don't want to lie on the ground. And as I said, if you want to be safe, you really need to get inside.
John Jensenius, lightning safety specialist with the National Weather Service in Maine. John, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And again, we've got our story, a deep look at lightning, posted at hereandnow.org. One man was hit six different times. You listen to that. Fascinating. Libya is suddenly back in the headlines. Libya's government, such as it is asking for international help after several oil tankers caught fire in those battles over control of the airport in Tripoli. The fighting continues there and across the country in the east in Benghazi, where more than 30 people died in clashes between the rival militias who've been battling for control since longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was brought down in 2011. The fighting is so bad that the U.S. evacuated its embassy in Tripoli over the weekend. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry.
We call on all Libyans to engage in the political process and to come together in order to avoid the violence. So many people died and gave so much effort to the birth of the new Libya.
The BBC's Rana Jawad joins us from Tripoli. And Rana, to the tanker fires there, how can anyone fight them while fighting between the militias continues around them?
There are firefighters on the scene. They've been there overnight, operating under very difficult circumstances. We understand that at some stage they did withdraw, but then they came back again when things got quiet again. They just play it by ear, essentially. There are also engineers who usually stay on that site, safety technicians as well. It just goes with the territory. They don't leave despite all the fighting, and we suppose they've been bunkered down for like at least 2 weeks now and just come out when the fighting dies down a bit. I know a colleague of mine from the French news agency AFP a photographer tried to get near there, and he couldn't earlier, and he just managed to get to about 500 or 400 meters away from it, and a Grad rocket fell about 70 to 100 meters away from him, and they had to pull back again. So it's that kind of reckless and sporadic firing of heavy armaments in that area that is very dangerous for not just the firefighters obviously trying to put out this flame, but also for a lot of residents who may feel trapped now.
Well, Rana, remind us, who are the players here in Tripoli, the capital, and in Benghazi? Of course, we know where the revolution that toppled Gaddafi started, and also where the U.S. consulate was attacked, four people, including Ambassador Stevens, killed. So who is the government? Who's running the country? And who are the different segments that are fighting?
Well, the government exists mostly on paper. It has been that way for over 2 years. A lot of observers will point out that what we're seeing in the west of Libya, and you know, there are two different contexts here when you look at the west and the east, but what we're seeing in Tripoli in the past 2 weeks is really a manifestation of what has happened over the last 2 years. The divisive politics that's been at play, the rise in political Islam, politicians constantly bickering and also using and bankrolling different militias.
Well, but this isn't sectarian fighting. What is it? Is it just power plays?
In Tripoli, it very much is. I mean, the thing is, you know, the two militias that are currently fighting each other are two of the biggest in the Western region. And one of them is bankrolled or is on official payroll, is under the Ministry of Defense. But they don't necessarily give them orders all the time. That militia doesn't take orders from the Ministry of Defense all the time. They still answer to their commander, and the militia that attacked, their rivals 2 weeks ago and continued to fight them are a coalition of different forces that are on official payroll as well by the outgoing parliament. They're the ones who formed them, and a lot of them are made up of senior Islamists within the ranks of that militia, joined by other militias or battalions from different cities that have formed an alliance of convenience, if you will, so that they can either take over the airport, which is seen as a significant cash cow for any group, but also, again, this being a reflection of the divisive politics over the last 2 years, it's also about power and the different political groups that are also somehow responsible for the scenario that is unfolding in Tripoli today, which many are describing as a fight for the soul of the country. In the East, it's a different context slightly in that it's more ideologically driven. We've seen the rise of some really powerful hardline Islamist groups like Ansar al-Sharia, who have been blamed for the attack against the U.S. consulate that killed four diplomatic staff, including the U.S. Ambassador then Chris Stevens in 2012, and others like them as well. They are purely ideologically driven. They don't recognize the state, and they've said as much, and they want to implement Sharia law. That's not the kind of rhetoric that we have heard here in the western part of Libya. And in the east, these militants have been fighting with a coalition of forces led by a former RAUG general who's brought some parts of the army under his wing and other militia groups to try and dislodge them from the city.
Well, Rana Jawad, we know you haven't slept at all, so we want to let you go. But what's the sense of what happens now? What's at stake? Is the sense that this is just the continuing shakeout from, you know, the deposing of Gaddafi, or is there something more serious that might happen?
It really is difficult to say. If I've learned, or if anyone really has learned anything about being based in Libya, is never try to predict anything here. This is such an unpredictable place when it comes to looking ahead. Everything is ad hoc. Everything changes every 5 minutes. People are worried. This could be a game changer for many different significant players on the scene and behind the scenes as well. The thing is, when you look at the weapons that is spread across the country, evenly so, it's very difficult for any group to rule the other. And in some ways, some see it as a blessing and a curse, that kind of spread of weapons around. Because as long as there is that kind of balance of power, the most these militia fights will achieve is a trail of destruction. None of them can really outgun the other when we look at the big militias that exist in Libya. But we'll have to wait and see.
The BBC's Rana Jawad in Tripoli. Rana, thank you.
Thank you.
You may not remember this story, but it shocked the world when it made headlines 4 years ago.
In South Korea, a mother and father are accused of starving their newborn daughter to death, all while spending endless hours playing online games.
What made the story even worse was that the game they were playing was a game in which the couple was raising a virtual child called an anima. Well, the story is the subject of a new HBO documentary that premieres tonight. It is called Love Child. Valerie Veach is the filmmaker. She's with us from KQED in San Francisco. Valerie, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Well, and the thing about this case of this couple that neglected their infant daughter who starved to death is it's not as cut and dried as it might seem, right?
Right. It became clear that this is really a moment in our kind of journey as a human race where the virtual world, or this kind of space we all share together, this networked space, has become quite real. And in the ruling of the case, the family received minimal jail time. The father ended up serving 1 year in jail, and the mother ended up serving no time. And the court ruled that they were addicted to the internet, and what that meant more specifically was that they were unable to distinguish the virtual world from the real world, which kind of removes culpability and creates a complex situation where we are in between this virtual world and this real world.
Well, and addicted to the internet, that's something that their lawyers wanted to be the case. They wanted to show that they were addicted to the internet just the way you'd be addicted to drugs.
Yes, their lawyer mounted this unprecedented defense where he spoke with a lot of doctors and research clinics and his own gaming experience. And it was this sort of whisper campaign of all of these people in the professional world in Korea saying, you know, I actually had a hard time stopping gaming so much, or my kids game a lot. And it just became clear that this is something that is indicative of a broader social shift that is occurring.
Well, and tell us about that, because you show Seoul, South Korea, and it looks very different than any major city in the U.S. It is really technologically advanced. There are screens everywhere, and it seems that it is a really big part of the culture for people to go to these gaming facilities that look like old-fashioned computer labs sit there at their screens and play internet games all day.
Yeah, well, the culture of PC bong rooms, which is those internet cafes, comes from two things. One is Korea, way back in the late 70s, created this information infrastructure plan where they built out in the 80s and 90s a super fast high-speed internet infrastructure. And when that went into place about 15 or 20 years ago, the result was Korea had an insanely fast internet all throughout the peninsula. And so there was a tax subsidy for the number of internet connections that a building could have. And so almost every single building in Korea, like each storefront or each block, has a internet cafe in it with maybe like 100 internet connections. And in those spaces, there's a real culture of gaming together. All of the people who are playing in the game are playing with the people that they're sitting right next to. And so there's a real sense of, you know, group and community atmosphere, which I find really interesting and a little bit different than how gaming operates in America, for instance.
But you have to assume that most of them do realize they're playing a game, right? It's just a game.
Absolutely. And to what extent is a game, you know, our reality? I think a lot of our cultural experiences, our shared cultural experiences, are these things that are suspended disbelief, like a movie or a song or a game. We kind of create these spaces of fantasy to interact culturally. And I think that's what these games are.
Let's listen here to journalist Andrew Salmon, who covered this case. And as he says in your film, he actually came to feel sorry for the couple at the center of the case. Here he is.
They struck me as being a rather pathetic pair of people. They'd clearly fallen through the cracks of society. Rather a sad couple. They were unaware of what they'd been doing. They had no information about raising children.
Valerie, did you find in your making of this film that there are other people just like this couple?
Yes. In October 2013, there was a U.S. couple who had a three-year-old daughter who died of starvation. And when they were arrested by the police officers, they discovered there had been 20 caseworker visits to the home where every time the parents were playing on the internet and not taking care of their child. And it turns out they were DJs in Second Life and earning their whole income through that space. In Korea, there's been a lot of these kinds of stories relating to parenthood and not, where, you know, the real life kind of falls away. You know, while I was in Korea in 2012, a big game called Diablo came out, and there was a 19-year-old kid who died of heart failure after playing it for like 72 hours straight. So the film, you know, really looks at, you know, how we can take this technology space, this virtual space, which is connecting us, which is creating empathy, which is, you know, creating this whole world, and integrate it with society and our, you know, human in, our social infrastructures in a way that makes sense and creates a better society.
Well, and we know that in South Korea, after this case became public and this young baby died, that laws were changed.
Yeah, so the policy fallout from this case was really interesting. One policy suggestion that went through was the Cinderella Law, where at a certain time of day, kids under 18 can't continue to play the games. You know, there's a lot of critique around that. You know, some people say it distorts the market. Then games are just being developed for an older crowd. You know, other people say it's ineffective because kids get around that law very easily by using someone else's social security number basically to get online. So part of what defines internet addiction and what is normal use versus overuse is just, and it's an ongoing dialogue. And I think, you know, it's changing as fast as our technology is changing. And I think the important thing is that we're having that dialogue.
Valerie, after doing this film, have you changed your own habits when it comes to not online gaming maybe, but just using technology?
Oh my gosh. So for this interview, I couldn't figure out how to turn my phone off on silent and it kept buzzing. So I had to take the battery out. And like right now, I feel so much anxiety with the battery out of my phone.
Oh, it's so an you actual, haven't like, gone away from technology?
No, I mean, I'm a techno-utopian. I love networked technologies. I think that with the right conversation and the right ethos and the right marketplace, we can really create a really positive tech sphere for humanity to interact in. We can build empathy. We can learn about the world. And so that's why a story like this is so interesting to me, because something like the death of a young child at the behest of parents being addicted to these games, which are designed to be addicting, to me, it's our job as citizens to challenge the tech world and to ask for better technology and to think really critically about how we're using it and how it's shaping our social fabric. And I think that by having that dialogue, we can create a better space. And so I really, you know, I'm very into technology. I'm very into my phone. It's a way to stay connected. And I think that's, it's important to look at how we're connecting then and to what purpose and to what end.
And to not go too far.
Right.
Filmmaker Valerie Veach. Her film is called Love Child, and it premieres tonight on HBO. Valerie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Wonderful talking.
And this is a story that affects all of us in a way, because we're all using our electronic devices more than we used to, sometimes too much. So should there be restrictions on gaming here in this country, online gaming and other kinds of computer games? And what do you think about the idea of being addicted to the internet? Is that a real condition, or was it just a convenient defense for this Korean couple? Let us know at hereandnow.org.